to Writing the Wrong Weight. I'm Jonathan Ball, your host. And I do a lot of things in the sense of being a writer of many stripes. I write, poetry, fiction, nonfiction. I do, this kind of writing instruction, and I write, articles and so on related to writing instruction. I do a lot of interviews, of course, on this podcast and, in print. I'm a screenwriter and, I've written joke horoscopes. I've written all sorts of things. And one of the things that I love to write the most is my newsletter. So if you go to strangeinc.ca, you can find my newsletter. You can join. You can get information on my projects. I send out new writing, writing I've been working on in draft. You can kind of get a clearer picture into what I'm doing. You can get some tips on writing yourself. And you can just get some good recommendations. I've got great things to recommend to you, like the movie Pineapple Express, which I'm going to talk about today. And Pineapple Express, if you haven't seen it, one, I'm going to ruin the movie for you. I'm going to literally walk through the plot step by step and tell you every sort of sequence in the plot and how it kind of builds towards this overall story. I'm going to analyze it from the point of view of a writer. And it will be, I think, a very useful example for you. You'll learn a lot looking at Pineapple Express, listening along with me as I look at Pineapple Express. But, it will kind of absolutely lay bare for you everything that happens in Pineapple Express. So do take a watch of that film first, if you ever intend to see it, before you listen to me talk, which I'll do right now. About Pineapple Express. Let's talk about Pineapple Express and walk through some of the things that are really worth noting from a writer's perspective. There are a lot of things to recommend about Pineapple Express. So one thing to note just quickly is that the genre that it sits in. Pineapple Express, of course, is a comedy. But put that aside, because comedy is a tone and a style and a genre that in many ways doesn't really operate like a genre. It doesn't have rules per se, other than one core rule, which is that the more we sympathize with the character, the less funny it is. Comedy is like a parasite on other genres, or much like horror in some respects. Horror is a more of a pure genre. Comedy has a approach. And it has that core principle that, we cannot sympathize with this person if we want to find them funny, their situation funny, I should say. We could like the person, but still want to see them suffer. That's often the situation in comedy. And I would wager that in Pineapple Express, we're sort of in that situation. Yes, we maybe like these people, but we don't really want to see things go well for them. We are detached from them. We're detached from their situation. We're not empathizing with them. We're not sympathizing with them. We have a level of remove, and we're finding it funny what is happening to them. There's a way to look at comedy. I forget who said it, but one of the purest ways to sum up what comedy is somebody once said, tragedy is when I get hurt, comedy is when you get hurt. And that's very much, the way the audience reacts to comedy. Now, we have seen in the modern era, the rise of a very popular blend called dramedy, comedy and drama sort of blended together. Probably the most successful example of this, artistically speaking, is The Office, where yes, it's very funny because we're very detached, but we will suddenly at moments come close to those characters and start to sort of feel bad and sympathize with them. And it becomes kind of cringy. We have to turn away from the thing. Or, you know, we'll kind of move in and out of actually caring about, you know, Pam and her relationship and so on. But it's very hard to handle the dramedy. It's very, very difficult because really you aren't actually in a comedy in those moments. What happens in a dramedy is we basically have a comedy that at certain moments moves out of being a comedy and into instead drama or, you know, even minor tragedy. And those moments, some audiences like when those moments are handled a certain way, and when they're deft and easy and quick and they're handled a certain way, they can be very powerful. But almost nobody can do it well. And almost everything that tries to insert a dramatic element, almost every comedy that tries to insert a dramatic element, you see this most often in sitcoms, absolutely crashes and burns once they bring the dramatic element in. And it becomes the worst thing about that show. But it does work. It does happen. Pineapple Express isn't really doing this, I want to point out. There's a lot of action and drama in that sense, but it's not true drama because it has this comic sheen. We're so detached from the characters, we don't really care fundamentally about them. Maybe we may like them, but we don't actually care about them in the sense that we want to see things go well for them. We don't want to see things go well for them. You know, maybe we don't want them to die and we want them to succeed. But that's just the basic way we want any character we're watching to succeed. Even if you're watching a film that has an anti-hero, you know, a psychopathic killer as your main character, there's a level at which you have to want them to succeed, maybe not in their life, but at their goal. You know, you're watching a movie, you're following a story, and this goal that the character has is, you know, a goal that you want to see succeed. You want to see them succeed in that goal. You're rooting for them, even if you hate them, right? The same is sort of true for Pineapple Express. We're rooting for them to accomplish their goals, but we have a level of detachment from caring about their situation. You know, we like them, but we also kind of like to watch bad things happen to them. That's sort of how comedy operates. So now that we moved into Pineapple Express, you know, Pineapple Express is a movie that really understands how comedy operates on a structural level. And because it understands how comedy operates on a structural level, it's free to do, to immerse itself in its actual genre, because its actual genre is an action film. You know, Pineapple Express is an action film. In fact, they hired a director better known for independent dramas who also, you know, could shoot action to direct it. You know, they didn't hire a comedy director to make this film. This is, of course, written by, you know, comedians. You know, those guys are in there as writers. And of course, it's, you can see in the scenes, there's a lot of improvisation that's going on between these actors. And they're, you know, clearly doing a bunch of versions and taking versions of the scene and cutting the one that they like the most. But it's also very tightly scripted in the sense that you really have the story locked and the plot, you know, constructed very carefully. And this is, I think, one of the biggest things you can learn from Pineapple Express. The way that comedy works best is that you just do a different genre that's not comedy. So you pick a genre like an action film, you pick a genre like a psychological drama, you pick a genre like horror even, you know, just pick a genre. And then as you're making that film, and as you're constructing that story and that plot, just like you would any other action film, any other, you know, whatever, you also adopt a tone of detachment where the audience, you construct ways that the audience, tonally speaking, can't fully empathize with your characters in their situation. You know, maybe they kind of see themselves reflected in that character, but there's a level of detachment there. Often because of the way that you pitch the world or the just the sort of way that they're positioned. the tone, like I say, plays so much into this in comedy. Once you kind of detach them a little bit from the and set that comedy tone, then really it just becomes about how to find a funny version of the plot point we need to get across to move this story forward. So with this in mind, I just want to walk you through the sort of way that the story works in terms of its sequences. If you actually look at Pineapple Express, there are basically 15 sequences. So again, these sequences, a collection of scenes, right? A scene is when you switch to time or location. A sequence is a collection of scenes that are orchestrated around a particular focus, you know, a particular conflict, a particular focus. We have this opening scene where we're establishing in a few instances. The opening scene on a sequence, I should say, jumps across time, right? So we first have, you know, this, the black and white lab that the, you know, the government lab where they're studying weed, they're trying to weaponize it basically, right? You know, or they're just kind of researching it. And we have, you know, Bill Hader there as this sort of subject. She's been exposed to the marijuana. And then, you know, they're asking him questions and so on and so forth. Eventually, they exterminate him. They shut the whole program down. Then we jump ahead in time to the, you know, present day where Seth Rogen is at his job. Now, when I say at his job, what I mean is that he's not anywhere. He's not located in a job. His job is, his office is his car. He's driving around. He's got all these costumes. He's driving around. He's serving people. He's a process server. And we're seeing, you know, him do that. And then we're seeing him go visit his girlfriend, you know, at high school. She's still in high school and he's dating her. And then we have him go get some weed from Franco. We were introduced, you know, to the drug dealer Franco. So there's really two sequences that I've described here, right? So first, we have this opening sequence. Where it's black and white, it's the government, you know, this, all this weed, you know, stuff. We're just, that sequence, I'll point out, has really nothing to do with the plot. The story hasn't actually begun yet. This opening sequence is just setting a theme and a tone. It's you know, setting us up for the comedy of it. It's setting us up thematically for this idea that weed is going to, you know, is somehow antisocial and is or is viewed as antisocial and is also a way that and is anti-authoritarian, right? Or anti-authoritative. There's this way in which it's just is against authority, however you want to parse that. It has this positioning outside of sanctioned American society, right? It's a fringe thing that has been excluded and from mainstream society, you know, from the government has reduced it to a fringe position. And there's this punishment that comes to those who indulge in weed outside of, you know, the sanctioned, you know, society. It's really exaggerating a lot of these ideas, ridiculously so, right? But it's thematically just setting those ideas up. Then we get the second sequence where we see Rogan. So we're introduced to our main character, you know, and we're introduced to exactly that kind of person. He's on the fringes of society. He doesn't have a real job in the sense that he's sort of driving around. His car is his office. He's putting on different costumes, right? He doesn't have a normal uniform for his work. He's got all these different uniforms. Everyone hates him. Everybody he, you know, meets in a day hates his guts, right? You know, he's serving them, you know, they hate his guts. And then he's, you know, we see his girlfriend, you know, he's an older dude out of high school dating a high schooler. It's weird. It's remarked upon that it's weird, you know, by the teacher who is even, you know, weirder than him. That guy finds him weird, right? This weird, creepy dude finds him weird and creepy. And then we're introduced to the drug dealer and Pineapple Express. We're told, you know, that Franco tells us, you know, that he's the only guy in town that has Pineapple Express. we get this sort of uncomfortable scenario where he's buying the weed and it's just this really uncomfortable position that he's in. He doesn't want to be there. He doesn't want to have to deal with a guy like Franco, but this is who you have to deal with if you want to buy weed in American society, and so on and so forth. So we have that thematic idea set up in the first sequence with the government black and white, lab stuff. Then we move into Rogan's life, and get introduced to this character, and we get that idea, that thematic idea is expressed in all these particular ways, in his job, in his relationships, in this with his girlfriend, and how people see that. We have him, again, everything is about this guy's on the fringes of society. He's been kind of socially ostracized in many respects, and he has to suffer the perspective of others. He's trying to avoid it. He doesn't want to go to the, dinner with her parents because he just knows how that's going to turn out. They're just going to see him as the weird pothead and so on and so forth, right? But he kind of gets pressured into it because he feels like he's going to lose this girl and so on. Plus then, we get established that there's this no good way to get weed, right? You have to hang out with Franco and, these other, it's always these shady, weird dudes that you got to deal with. And he just is trying to live a normal life and be a normal dude, but he can't because he's been ostracized in all these different ways due to his drug use. So all it gets kind of thematically established. And then we get moved into like talking to him and seeing who this person is that we're going to follow in the movie. But also notice all the really significant plot things that are happening in that first opening sequence. We're seeing the base that later, is going to ironically become the grow op that, Ted Jones has. We have Ted Jones mentioned, like that's the guy he's going to go serve next, right? So the plot is sort of progressing in this way. And Franco notes, Ted Jones is a big drug dealer, and so on. Note that Franco also says he's the only guy in town that has Pineapple Express. So all this information that's very important to the plot is starting to get out, but in a way that we're not really paying too much attention or noticing it, but it's being set up. Then, the third sequence is when he witnesses the murder. They see that somebody witnessed it. He drops the Pineapple Express. They find the Pineapple Express. Now they're after him, right? So that's a very short sequence, but it establishes that, that's the big catalytic moment, right? Where the conflict really starts to rise. He gets in deep. They know that somebody witnessed this murder. They know they were smoking Pineapple Express. The fourth sequence leads directly from that, right? Where Franco and Rogan are, Saul and Dale are having a conversation about, Ted. We have got some really wonderful lines in there. What do you know about Ted? I think he's crazy about murdering. That's one of my favorite, that's my favorite moments. I think he's crazy about murdering. He's like, well, that's not good. So they're on the, they kind of realize like they're on the run effectively by this point. We go back to that plot element, that idea that he's the only guy who has Pineapple Express. Therefore, there's a line to find Dale, and to find Saul. We go, they put it together real quick for us if we haven't already thought of it, right? Ted makes Pineapple, sells Pineapple Express. He sells it to Red. Red sells it to Saul. Saul sold it to Dale. And there's and Ted maybe not doesn't know who Dale is, but he knows how to get to Red. He knows how to get to Saul. He knows that Saul is how he's going to get to Dale. So this establishes a number of things very quickly in this sequence. Look at the elegance of this. We have established a direct line of threat to Dale. We have Dale and Saul discussing precisely like how this could happen. We have the question mark of, well, we have a goal for them to accomplish. They got to go get try to figure out. They got to get on the run. They got to see if they can get a hold of Red and see, has Red been approached by Ted? Has he told Ted anything? And so on and so forth. They have like some actual goals, right? But also notice something that's not so obvious that is also happening here. Dale has put together that Saul is the link to Dale and that Saul could give Dale up. And so Dale has attached himself to Saul. You know, Dale is hauling Saul around with him, not because they're best buds all of a sudden, the way that Saul thinks, but because he can't trust Saul. He's precisely tied to Saul, just like he was. He didn't want to be around Saul in the first place, but that's the guy he got his weed from. So there's this fake, you know, relationship that has been constructed because Dale is using Saul. And here again, we have this fake kind of kinship that gets deepened because once more, Dale is using Saul. In this case, he's using him not to get weed, but to try to hide. And if he is hanging out with Saul, they can't find Saul. If Saul's running around on the run from him, he's put Saul into danger by causing Saul to more closely associate with him. And there's this way in which he's actually using Saul and in a way that maybe he's not fully aware of. And I don't think the audience is even really fully aware of. Plus note that they do this practical, we have this really funny sequence where they go in the woods and so on. And there's, you know, all this sort of business, funny business that happens in the woods. I want you to notice though, as a writer, notice that the point plot-wise of them being in the woods and all this stuff happening is so that they lose their cell phones. This is a great problem that a lot of screenwriters have in the modern age. Everybody's got cell phones in real life, right? Cell phones are death in movies almost always. You know, it's just, there's so many movies where if you watch them, you wonder, like, why don't they just phone this dude? They all got cell phones. It's unrealistic that they don't have a cell phone, right? Why can't they just, you know, make a call and sort all this stuff out? One of your jobs as a screenwriter often is to figure out how to get rid of the cell phone in a way that makes sort of plot sense. So, you know, here's the funniest possible way to do it, right? Maybe you could think of a funnier way, but like the point is, you know, they realize from a writing perspective, they need to get rid of these phones so the characters don't have the ability to call one another, you know, in such an easy manner. They got to go to pay phones. They try to make it really difficult and they're trying to get back to, you know, kind of a pre-cell phone age in the script without setting it there. The cheap, easy way is to set it there, but you lose all the, you know, there's a lot of budgetary problems with doing that, but also you lose like the story potential of other characters having cell phones and so on. The solution they have, I think, is really, you know, clever and elegant. You know, find a funny way to get rid of the phones where these guys actually smash the phones and throw them away and everything. The fifth sequence is the red fight. So they go to, we establish, you know, before this that Red is in cahoots already with Ted. They go to Red. We have this very funny kind of back and forth. This is, again, a great example of, in a comedy, we've got a scene or a sequence. In this case, it's a very long scene. That is the majority of the sequence where we have them fighting, you know, at Red's house, and then they have this big discussion with Red, and they have a fight with Red. That is a great example of how to work a comedy. We have a very high stakes, high conflict scene where characters have very clear goals, dramatic goals. But all the surface level stuff is funny. You know, we have him making a cat's birthday cake. You know what, you know, again, great, great writing lesson is while characters talking about something, just have them doing a thing. You know, have them like do something with their hands. You know, they're actually, he's putting the cake together. He's not just talking about it. He's making the cake. And then of course they can use that cake and the fight and so on, right? Like, we have this great little moment where, they argue about whether he said, or uh-huh. It's such a great, you know, piece of writing, that maybe isn't even written. I mean, you know, you'd have to, again, you look at the script, you'll see whether that's in there exactly, right? But that kind of stuff is very much the kind of thing that is really possible to, you know, work and make work only if you've got the right actors. You know, you can get that stuff in your scripts, but you got to also be mindful that, you know, there's a level at which you need to really make it clear to the actors how that could or should we play it? We have, you know, part six, sequence six, this chase sequence. We have the kind of where they're being chased. We have the conflict between the gangsters really sort of occupy most of that sequence. They're on the run, but really this is the car chase yet. This is the scene where like we have like people pursuing them. So, and we get a fuller introduction to the gangsters. You know, we get a sense of their conflict, right? That conflict is funny and it helps establish their characters relative to one another, but also sets up things that are gonna actually happen in the plot later. It sets up that this guy just wants to go home. It sets up that, you know, Craig Robinson might kill his partner and, you know, take that out. It sets up, you know, the Asian gang, right? You know, Asians know about him and so on. They think he's a killer for the Asians. So that whole gang war, the larger conflict that's taking place around them that they're not really fully aware of, gets established. We also get the establishment of a runner, a running joke, which is, you know, a very standard running joke. They don't do too much with this, but it's kind of a funny thing that they run through it, which is that Ted thinks Dale is some sort of master, you know, assassin. And he takes all these, it's kind of like the Get Smart plot, you know, Get Smart is an old TV show that used this premise a lot. Inspector Gadget is kind of a TV version of, or a cartoon version of it. But the idea, it's a very old kind of comic plot, the idea that a person would be a bumbling idiot, but everyone would think they're some sort of, you know, master genius, just pretending to be an idiot and so on. Then we have this sequence at Angie's, you know, sequence seven, where again, we have some really effective writing happening. We get it reestablished. One of the things they've done really cleverly in this plot is they have set up that one of the murderers that he sees, and it's very important that he sees this, is a cop. So that takes care of the other problem that a modern writer often has, which is that why don't the characters just call the police? So that's been taken care of, but just in case we're wondering that by that this point in the movie, he says and establishes, you know, we can't call the police, they're the murderers. Angie starts, agrees to go to safety. We have a whole, you know, again, sequence where there's lots of stuff that sort of is happening at that house. Then we have, you know, a very short kind of sequence after that where Ted and the Asian gang, their conflict escalates primarily because Ted shows all this weakness in front. So it escalates the overall conflict where like Dale has actually caused a gang war and produced this more high stakes, more intense situation. It's easy to overlook this fact because Dale's not really in that sequence. This is really like a sequence between Ted and the you know, other crime boss. But please note that later on, when they're in the underground research lab and we have like that kind of SWAT, it's not a SWAT team because it's the Asian gang, but like they're kind of operating like a SWAT team. They're all like in black and, you know, going through like a mobilized unit. Please note that the only reason all that is happening is because of Dale. You know, he's unwittingly, accidentally initiated a gang war or escalated a gang war here. And he's the one who has actually accidentally caused the situation to develop by pushing Ted. Ted has, you know, made a mistake, so on. So the stakes are rising because more and more conflict is exploding around Dale. Sequence nine is sort of them sort of bonding, right? You know, they try to decide to get out of town. They're going to leave. They try to get some money. They get kind of busted. And then we move into, you know, this car chase. So it starts with them sort of bonding. It eventually escalates into a car chase where they're on the run. And we get more firmly entrenched the idea there is no outside help. You know, the cops aren't going to help them. They're not going to save them. And if anything, where to help them, it's just going to make things worse because these guys just can't function. So that sequence, you know, plays out. Eventually we get this really exciting, you know, action sequence of car chase. We have them split up in this 10th sequence, sequence 10, you know, the friendship is over. They split up, you know, they have this, you know, argument. They're sort of at their lowest point in that respect. He has this call with Angie. They break up, you know, so he's really, Dale has started to hit his lowest point. We're kind of in the dark, you know, night of soul there. And I want to, again, just return to the thematic idea. You know, think of Dan O'Bannon's idea of dynamic conflict. But we're getting like push and pull. You know, so as Dale is doing a thing, it's being reacted to by Saul. They have sort of this internal conflict that kind of starts to go back and forth, because fundamentally what's in conflict interpersonally with them is that Saul wants to be friends with Dale. Dale doesn't want to be Saul's friend. Saul's being a good friend. Dale is just using Saul. And once Dale starts to really, until Dale starts to really realize that, he isn't really able to resolve that conflict. And it just starts to get as become clearer and clearer until finally, like, Saul starts to point it out to him. And they get into a big fight and so on. That Saul seems much more aware than he seems to be, you know. What we get increasingly throughout this film is this idea that Dale lacks self-awareness. And as the film goes on, he is increasing in self-awareness. And everyone around him has more self-awareness. Eventually we get to sequence 11, where the killers have found him. Dale discovers that Saul has been kidnapped. The killers found Saul. Dale goes and recruits Red to get him back. You know, and they all, you know, have this big scene as they get montage as they get ready and they pump each other up. Then, you know, sequence 12, they get to the barn. Red immediately bails, you know, in a really funny moment. Dale's immediately gets captured. And then, you know, the two are reunited. So we have sort of this reunion sequence. Then, you know, we have sequence 13 where they basically escape, right? We have a bunch of funny business as they escape, and partially their escape is abetted by this kind of Asian invasion of the barn and the below lab that has been converted into a grow up. Eventually they get split up. And, you know, we have like sequence 14 there where all the conflict really escalates. They go from kind of escaping to actually more or less their escape is foiled and they have to sort of fight. The bomb gets set, it blows up and so on. Red returns, right? We have all these Franco returns. Everything escalates to this climax. Then, you know, sequence 15 is sort of just ending it off. They emerge somewhat triumphant. Red even has survived. They have this little kind of coda at the diner where they sort of talk about things that have happened. So look at the plot elegance of that. You know, look at how the action movie sequences are really working. They really escalate. They move. We have this sort of trajectory of the character where he becomes more and more self-aware and he starts to accept his position as a person who's at the fringe of a society. He starts to even embrace his outsider position in a way, you know, and celebrate it rather than wanting to live a normal life and it being sort of, but he feels like he can't because, you know, weed's not legal and his dealer is a jerk, an idiot, and all this stuff that just keeps happening to him. He eventually starts to take responsibility for what's happening around him. He doesn't quit weed. He just embraces it as, you know, part of a lifestyle that he's going to, and he's going to stop blaming it for the bad things in his life. And, you know, he's going to stop blaming, you know, people around him. He's instead going to, you know, with the help of the weed, it's kind of an interesting trajectory because
they kind of set you on this trajectory, like, oh, what he'll do is he'll give it up, and he'll become a normal for sort of functioning member of society. And he'll realize, you know, that he needs to just fully integrate, you know, become, he needs to grow up. That's sort of the trajectory they set this character on. And then they start to twist it and turn it. So really by the end, he's like, no, I don't really need to grow up. I can be a grown up. I can be a man, you know, I can be, you know, a person who has responsibility in their life. And also, incidentally, you know, instead of organizing my life around weed, it can become a part of my life. And as I've sort of got, you know, more of a focus on these relationships, by the end, they're all bonding, right? You know, the focus is more on relationships that they've come into, where the weed is, you know, around, but it's not really the sole reason for the relationship, like it is with, you know, him and Saul originally. He hasn't organized his life now around the weed. He's found like a sort of truer thing, you know, friendship to organize his life around. Even his girlfriend, he doesn't need anymore. You know, he doesn't need these. In many respects, you know, she gets a short shrift in this movie. You know, she's a character who doesn't really have much to do. And you could really question, does she even need to be in the movie? It does allow them some funny business. It allows this really fun, you know, moment where wins her back and then immediately is like, oh, this is a mistake. You know, I clearly, you know, am less mature than I thought. And I need to grow up. And part of me growing up, I thought it was, you know, giving up weed and becoming a normal sort of getting an office job, but really it means, you know, giving up, you know, wanting those things, and, you know, giving you up, this sort of normal person who's going to have a normal life. You know, you need to kind of go, so I can have, you know, my life, which is not going to be normal. And instead he can revel, and have some fun with his friends. It's a very much, you know, a movie about smoking weed with your friends. And on one level, it's not much more complicated than that. But on this other level, it has this whole, you know, a metaphorical structure that surrounds it. But otherwise, I find, I mean, I'm not a guy who smokes weed or anything. So I've generally am not a fan of, you know, stoner films because they just, I don't find them super funny. But this one is great. And I think the reason it works so well is because they really have taken this genre, you know, the action movie genre that fundamentally is not about growth and not about change. And they've turned it inside out and really kind of deconstructed it as they've made sort of every aspect of it just sort of into a funny twist on what you'd normally encounter.